and welcome again to It's Innate, a podcast by two developmental psychologists, four developmental psychologists, and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I'm Candy LaPan.
And I'm Dion Benton. And we are the It's Innate podcast. Welcome back to a second episode. Hi, Candy.
Hi, Dion. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing quite well. I'm excited about this particular episode. I'm sure that we may get on a few people's bad sides.
We might.
Like I said last time, my admonition is that these are our opinions based on our limited, or rather our reading of the literature. And people are free to and encouraged to disagree with us and to email us and to DM us on Twitter if they'd like to have a discussion about some of the stuff we talk about. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about our topic today. I think it is one of the, if I should dare to use the term, sexy topics in infant research. So we're going to be talking about that claim that we've heard for a while now about infants' ability to do math. Mm-hmm. But before we get into that, we had planned to talk about that for our episode today, but some recent events and conversations caught our attention on one of our developmental psych listservs, and so we wanted to chat a bit about that.
Yes. So do you want to kind of go over what the email was about, maybe?
Yeah, so this was a, again, I think probably a continued debate about some of these ideas about what we're measuring in our tasks that we use with infants, but as well as older children. And so there had been a call out about a study, or if other researchers wanted to engage and collect data for a particular study, and somebody responded to that email by sort of questioning the particular method. So specifically, they were questioning whether or not these infant studies that use puppets, for example, to measure infants' social inferences or theory of mind, if we're then actually really studying infants' theory of mind, and whether or not they are making inferences about the researcher, or do they are actually making inferences about a puppet's mental states. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of how the conversation started. And then there was some back and forth about that.
Yeah. here's where I'll give a shout out to my good friend, Jonathan Kuminsky. So to provide a bit more context, the email exchange was between a guy named Martin Packer and my friend Jonathan Kuminsky, who was a postdoc at Rutgers, and I believe that he moved elsewhere with his mentor, Elizabeth Bonowitz, although I'm not exactly sure where. And so Jonathan's response, he responded by arguing that using stimuli like puppets is actually the better way to go when looking at things like theory of mind. And the idea is that by using these more impoverished stimuli, you can sort of better tap into the mechanism or the process that gives rise to pro-social detection. And so he drew an analogy between that literature and the causal perception literature. And sort of what he argued is that for those who study causal perception, the principal paradigm that's used is the Machadian launching event paradigm. These are basically billiard ball-like sequences where infants are shown that object A makes contact with object B and object B begins to move. However, what distinguishes these events from actual billiard ball sequences is that these are two-dimensional artificial stimuli. And he argues that when researchers use this kind of paradigm, they are in fact getting at causal perception, even though the stimuli are impoverished. And we know that because infants respond quite differently to causal events than they do to non-causal events. And so there is quite a bit of research with infants starting at about 6 months of age showing that they privilege events where object A makes object B move immediately upon spatial contact, and importantly, they distinguish those events from non-causal events. But another reason we know that infants are, or at least we think we know that infants are perceiving cause and effect, is because their responses to these events mirror the responses of adults. And so again, although these studies rely on impoverished stimuli, there's reason to think that we are in fact getting at the construct of interest, which in this case would be causal perception. And so by analogy, he argues, there's sort of, I guess, this concern about using puppets may be a bit unwarranted, and that perhaps researchers are in fact, who study theory of mind, are in fact looking at and getting at that construct. That was sort of the argument, or at least the rejoinder.
Yeah, and I think I sort of saw this also as that I think some of these are, to me, it's slightly different. Like, we talk about the relation between causal reasoning and maybe like physical objects, and then causal reasoning in humans, like reasoning about causality of human behavior, which is what we're talking about with theory of mind, or making mental state inferences. And I think that in the conversations and back and forth, those were sort of used interchangeably, but I think I perceive those as very different. Maybe not necessarily always in the methodology that we use to study them, but this idea that like an object coming into contact with another object will make it move, and that causal understanding versus understanding that like a puppet that helps another puppet is a nice puppet and I will then like that puppet. I feel like that's a very different type of sequence of thought and requires a different type of skill and inference.
Well,
and there might be more caveats to studying that type of thing, that type of social inference, with very impoverished stimuli, because our claims then are specifically about our inferences about people, versus in the studies you're talking about, and Dion, the type of work that you do, we're making claims about infants' understanding of objects. And so that would make more sense in that case. So I thought that was an interesting part of the conversation that didn't seem to really come up.
Right. So I will say that I don't actually think, to defend and to play devil's advocate a bit, I don't...
We always like that.
Yeah, I don't think that Jonathan is drawing an analogy in that sense. That is, I don't think he's claiming that these two different literatures are studying the same thing. I think what he's saying is that in the causal perception case, we know that we're getting at causal perception despite the fact that we're using these impoverished stimuli, again, because infants respond to these events in very systematic ways that you would expect if, for example, they possess some sort of mechanism that allows them to detect causal perception. And in the same way, even though studies that look at theory of mind with children tend to use these impoverished stimuli, there's reason to think that they're responding to these kind of events in systematic ways, in ways that you might predict if in fact children showed sensitivity. And I think that's the key. And so while I agree with you, I want to sort of touch on another point you made. While I agree with you that there is something fundamentally different about studying causal perception in the context of these artificial two-dimensional circles that make contact with each other and studying causal perception in the real world, I think one of the benefits, again, to sort of argue in favor of these more impoverished paradigms, is that by using these paradigms that are a bit rich, that use people, for example, people that move in all sorts of ways, it's hard to really isolate what is driving an infant or a kid's response. And so this sort of, I think, warrants the sort of investigating these constructs in the context of these more impoverished environments. And then the idea is that once you've isolated, for example, the mechanism or the process that's giving rise to the behavior in question, whether it be causality on the one hand or theory of mind on the other, then you scale up. And incidentally, yeah, I will say this is actually where modeling can be quite useful. Right. So one of the useful functions of a computational model is you can actually implement mechanism and see if in different simulations the model gives rise to behavior that infants comport with. And the idea is that once you've isolated the mechanism in the context of a computational model, you can scale up and expose the model to ever richer environments to see to what extent the mechanism in question is robust to this richer world. And so this is precisely where modeling is and can be quite useful in teasing apart some of these very important questions. So while I disagree with, in theory, with Martin, I do agree that it's important to, you know, to get at whether or not, to answer whether or not we're studying the construct in question. So in the case of the back and forth between Jonathan and Martin, whether we're actually getting at theory of mind. And there, I think it's important to do two kinds of experiments, one with the impoverished stimuli and one with the richer stimuli. And the idea
I agree. Yeah, I think that there's just, it's very often, I mean, and I think that as researchers, we often do that. We can pick a side and really stick to it. And it doesn't have to be one or the other. We can appreciate, you know, I don't do that type of research, but I still appreciate and can take away something from that research. And I think that we need both lines. And so we talk about this from the basic principles of science of external and internal validity. And often when we have these highly controlled experiments and labs with very impoverished stimuli, they might not have great external validity in the real world, but we have maybe better internal validity at measuring the construct that we believe we're measuring. So we need both of these types of studies to really follow up on these questions. I think that we'll talk about, I think we'll end up coming back to this conversation a bit more when we talk about more of that specific type of literature. So more of Kylie Hamlin's research with helpers and hinderers, because I think, again, and this will be a topic of conversation for today as well, is a lot of this has to do with the conclusions that we draw too. So depending on how we frame and talk about our research, the findings may be valid within themselves, but then our interpretation of them might be kind of overstepping our claims. We have to make sure we temper our claims, again, whether we're using real-world stimuli, and then we have to say, well, there's a lot of noise. We might not be sure exactly what infants or children are responding to, or that they might be more familiar with these situations, and so that might color their perception in one way. And then on the other end, when we do these highly controlled experiments with novel stimuli, then we have to temper our claims to make sure that they match actually what we did in our study. And so I think that that's often a disconnect, and that's a pattern of disconnect that we see in some of the literature. But yeah, I saw this back and forth go a couple times responding, and I think that that was the last one that I saw. It came sort of down to that and talking about whether or not using these types of stimuli really relates to children's social evaluation or witnessing social interactions when we're using geometric shapes with googly eyes on them, and is that really the same thing as making inferences about social interaction? So. Yeah. I thought it was really, really interesting linking some of the different work that people have done and hearing the discussion back and forth. It made me excited to talk about today.
Yeah, I agree. This goes back to the sort of the mantra we brought up in the last conversation. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And
say it again.
Yeah, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And until you have that evidence, which often comes in the form of, just to recapitulate what you're saying, because I agree 100% with what you're saying, like once you have that evidence in the form of controls, then you, I think, are a bit more justified. But I think that's not enough. And in our discussion of this paper today, or these papers today, I will bring up another point that I think researchers have to address in order to, if the desire is to make these extraordinary claims. It's not enough to carefully control different variables. I think the stats have to match up. And I'm sure you know exactly what I'm getting at. We'll discuss that.
Yeah, I feel like we just have to jump into it. So yeah. this is obviously, I feel like most people that are listening to this podcast are familiar with this paper, but we're talking about the Karen Wynn paper from, what is this, 1992.
It's been cited, by the way, as of yesterday at about 5 p.m., 2,227 times. Whew. And I think there's something to be said about the number of times a paper has been cited and the relationship between the number of times that a paper has been cited and one's confidence in the findings, which I think, in this case at least, are unwarranted. And I will say again before jumping into this conversation that we're making an argument about the results and the interpretation of the results. I do not know Karen Wynn. I'm sure she's a fantastic person. So what I will say in this podcast is strictly about the science. And so I'm going to try to keep it to the science.
Yes, absolutely. We're always can be critical of science, right, or of claims. Doesn't mean that we're being critical of a person. But I think that there are definitely some issues here. So do we want to give like the general gist for anybody that might not be familiar with this paradigm? And
yeah, so I will say, just to provide some background.
Yeah.
So this research, the Karen Wynn study that we're talking about and the research that precedes it, involved investigations into children's numerical capacities. And this literature, as of today at least, has like a rich nearly 40-year history. And it actually began with investigations into infants' subitization abilities. And so this refers to one's ability to determine precisely how many items make up a small set. And the first group to sort of look at this capacity are a couple of researchers named Starkey and Cooper. And they investigated five-month-olds' abilities to distinguish between arrays of dots that consist of two dots and arrays of dots that consist of three dots. And what they find in that study is that five-month-olds have no trouble at distinguishing between these two arrays, but when you increase the number of dots in each array, their performance falls apart. And this sort of basic finding has been replicated a number of times, although research by sort of Clearfield and Mix in 99 tells a slightly different story, but that's roughly the sort of idea. And in addition, there's some work suggesting that infants can detect the sort of numerical correspondences between two different modalities. So for example, Starkey, Spelke, and Gelman, they showed that infants can match the number of sounds to a visual display that depicts that number. And so given this evidence, although it's sort of somewhat mixed, Karen Wynn decided to examine the extent to which infants can go further and they can perform mental operations. That is, she was interested in whether infants can add and subtract small numbers. So that's the basic, that's the overview, the background of the study. Maybe we can sort of walk the listener through the actual design. Although, like you said, I'm sure anybody who's a developmental psychologist would have read this, read about the study, or will have heard about the study, or taught it.
We can give really, really just basic overview in case this isn't your specific area.
Yep.
The layout of the study is using looking times, and so infants are shown a little display. They see an item. I think in the actual original study, it was like a Mickey Mouse doll.
That's right.
They see that up on the display, and then an occluder comes up. They see a hand reach into the display and either add or subtract items depending on conditions. And then when the screen comes down so that the infants can see the whole display again, they either see what should be expected, so the correct number of dolls on the display, whether or not that was whichever number, there are various conditions there again, or they see impossible displays. So there should be two items, but actually there's only one, or the reverse. There should be one item, but there's two. And this paper, if you're familiar with actually reading it, I'll also say, starting off, is it's very brief in a whole lot of stuff that's in there. So looking for more details for some of the things in there that I wish that I could know. Not too many details in that particular paper.
Well, I mean, I wonder if some of that has to do with the fact that this was published in Science. I mean,
I get it. Yeah, don't get me wrong, but
I'm not an illustrious psychologist by any stretch of the imagination. So, like, I don't know if I'll ever be able to publish in a journal like that, but I think one of the reasons is because, in fact, it was published in Science. But
yeah, but again, I'm back to that original thing of like extraordinary claims, extraordinary evidence, and if you're really I will get to this, I'm sure, in pointing out some of the extremely strong claims in this paper. There's not a whole lot of information. I think especially this is a historical difference too, as we move towards more open science practices and really sharing data and sharing a lot more information about methodology. Reading this, I was like, I don't even really know.
You have to wonder.
Think about some of this.
You have to wonder if something like this would be able to get published nowadays. I mean,
I can't. I don't know.
I mean, it would be interesting to try. Yeah. You know, it might be a waste of time.
Literally, for our listeners, for context, it's 2 pages for a 3-study paper.
Yep. All right, so as Candy just eloquently stated, the infants were, well, technically, the infants were assigned to, in the study, 2 different conditions. So yeah. They were assigned to a condition called the addition condition. Actually, in the paper, it was called the 1+1 condition. The second half of infants were assigned to the subtraction condition. Mm-hmm. And what she finds in both conditions is that the babies look longer at the impossible event. So in the addition condition, after seeing initially one object placed on the stage, a screen rotating up, and then a second object being placed behind the screen, when the screen is subsequently lowered, the infants look longer when they were shown a test event that showed an outcome of 1 than a test event that showed an outcome of 2. Likewise, the infants in the subtraction condition, after seeing initially a stage that had 2 Mickey Mouse dolls on it, and then the screen rolling up, and at that point, the experimenter removes one of the two dolls, the infants look longer at an outcome of 2 rather than 1. And based on this finding, the conclusion I'm going to read exactly from the paper, just so I don't, you know... So what she says is the results from the 3 experiments support the claim that 5-month-old infants, and here's what was actually said in the paper, infants are able to calculate the precise result of simple additions and subtractions. And she also goes on to say toward the end of the paper that the existence of these arithmetical abilities so early in infancy suggests that humans innately possess the capacity to perform simple arithmetical calculations.
Whew.
Yeah, those are some hefty claims for a very impoverished study.
Very strong claims. Very. Especially, I mean, when I read the sentence about innate, like these abilities being innate, that this was, I mean, such a bold claim, not tempered in any way.
No. Why? I mean, go big or go home. Fuck that. Whew. You know. Never mind that these were 5-month-olds, and never mind that they had a full 5 months to learn all the relevant contingencies that one would need to know to be able to succeed in this task. Never mind that.
Yeah, no. Just 5 months. If there's anything present at that time, it has to be innate.
Of course. What the hell?
Of course. Where else would it come from? No, I think that was one of the big ones that was problematic for me, of course, when I saw that. Making claims about innateness when you're testing 5-month-old infants, there's not really evidence of anything in that study to suggest that those abilities are innate. Like, not at all. Yeah. I don't think that there's anything there to suggest that. So I'm not really.
Let's get into what we would need. Like, what would actually convince Dr. LePan and Dr. Benton that these infants not only can add and subtract, but that this ability is in fact innate? I think it's okay to sort of argue that we disagree, but let's drill down and discuss precisely why we don't agree with this conclusion. Mm-hmm. I'll be a gentleman. I'll let you go first.
Well, I think there are two separate points. So the first is evidence that I would need for something to be innate. That's, I mean, our more basic question. And I think that this is relevant, too, because we'll come back to this quite again and again in the different things we talk about. To really make a strong claim that some ability is innate, that we are born with this ability, there has to be a much earlier age range that you're demonstrating these capabilities. But, so 5 months or 6 months of age has significant experience with the world, especially considering that infants don't do a whole lot besides sit around and look at things for the first 6 months of their life. So they're witnessing and observing people, objects, things coming and going. So there's a lot of time to take in the world and learn about, normal patterns of behavior or patterns of objects or relations between objects. So I think that's maybe the simplest one, is that I would expect to see evidence of that capability much earlier in infancy.
But as you know, one rejoinder that you may well get with making that kind of argument is that, okay, let's say we do test infants who are younger than 5 months, like infants who are closer to birth. Let's say we test, for the sake of argument, we test 1-month-olds. And we show, for example, that they don't respond in the way that that Karen Wynn is showing. That is, they no longer show extended looking to the impossible event. How do we know at that stage or with that result that failure is a function of the lack of a capacity to add and subtract, or rather, and this is a common argument that's made from people who subscribe to the nativist position, that how do you know that this is just not a result of some sort of performance limitation? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, maybe they do espouse this ability, but that, like, testing 1 month olds, they just don't have these auxiliary capacities to support something as sophisticated as adding and subtracting small numbers. Like, sure. What does,
no, I, you know, I totally understand that argument. I think one, there just has to be advances in some other types of methodology. Like, if you're really going to try and get at these, we're using looking times. And so even in infants that we can use habituation techniques with, or we can use looking time preference with, there's still a lot of limitations in that because infants are fussy and infants have a hard time in some of those paradigms. So I think that one is an advance in methodology that we need. And I'm sure you're probably more familiar with some of the advances in that area because I tend to study older kids. But the other thing is that...
I hate to disappoint you. I'm not. I stick strictly with looking time and... Yeah,
I would say for me, the other thing is, if you're trying to claim that an infant could really have this much more sophisticated ability, but yet maybe lack in other types of basic functions like attention, that seems contradictory to me that you could then possess a really advanced, sophisticated ability, yet lack in a really super basic ability to just sustain attention on an object for more than a second. That seems a little bit hard for me to accept as right. a full explanation.
And even if that is the argument, like, let's say that is the argument, let's just grant them that argument. Mm-hmm. Like, even if that is the case, I think you should still temper your claims. And if let's say that you are fully aware that if someone were to make this argument, you would respond by saying, well, there's probably performance limitations. Well, then you need to design those experiments that circumvent those performance limitations. If in fact the claim that you want to make is that in this case, infants can add and subtract, mm-hmm. barring those controls, so to speak, I think it's important to, again, to temper the claims. And so you're absolutely right that, you know, I think there is something to be said about these performance limitations. But again, mm-hmm. there's also something to be said about tempering your claims. And until you run the right kinds of studies that sort of help to get around, circumvent these performance limitations, it's important, again, to be careful about what you're claiming a five-month-old who can barely hold up his or her head can do.
Yeah, I agree. And this study, I think, this study is so impactful in the types of things that Karen Wynn looks at and the ideas that she put forward and the claims that she was trying to test. And I really think that it probably moved a lot of things forward and people thinking about and a lot of research along these lines that get us to think about what infants may be capable of, but it comes down to those claims in the end that you're making and how you're interpreting the findings. What do you think that these really mean? And that's where it starts to become more problematic.
Absolutely. Now, I'll mention, we'll just sort of go one for one. So one of my issues with this paper is that, as you might well expect, there aren't the right kinds of controls aren't run. So let me be clear. Let me be specific. So the argument was made that the infants looked longer at the impossible event because it was numerically impossible. Well, it turns out that there's an alternative explanation, as you might well expect, for this pattern of looking. So the infants, just as a reminder, just to provide context, the infants in the addition condition, they looked longer at the outcome of one, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than the possible outcome of two. Well, another reason they may well have looked longer at that event is because it was directionally inconsistent with what they saw. So let me be clear about what I mean by that. So during habituation, let's say that the infants weren't adding and subtracting in the way that Karen Wynn is sort of saying they were. Let's say instead that they, as they witnessed more objects being placed on the stage, they sort of formed a hypothesis that said, okay, Because more objects are being placed on the stage, I expect there to be more of the thing when the screen is lowered. Now, of course, just to be clear, what this hypothesis predicts is not that infants would be able to tell you or show you through their pattern of looking that the one outcome is impossible because it's numerically impossible. Rather, the one outcome is inconsistent with the direction of the habituation of the familiarization events. That is, as more objects are placed on the stage, there should be more of the in this case the Mickey Mouse dolls on the stage. And so the outcome of one is directionally inconsistent with what they would have seen during this initial 1+1 trial. And so a second possibility, of course, a simpler explanation is that maybe they just simply looked longer at the one outcome because, again, it was directionally inconsistent with what they had seen during the familiarization phase. And so this, of course, requires an additional experiment that sort of would help to rule this out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in her experiment 3, I think she sort of started to get at that.
But she doesn't go far enough.
Do
you want to explain, just to provide some context, do you want to explain what happened?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so in her 3rd experiment, she tests partially what Dion just mentioned. So she says, okay, well, if it is about directionality, then in a case where we have one item on the stage, a second item is added, but then when the screen comes down, it reveals 3 items. That's in the right direction, but it's not the exact numerical amount of items that you should see in that display. And so she predicted that infants would look longer at a display with 3 items than a display with 2 items. So again, now 3 is an impossible event in that case, but it is at least in the right direction. So that would sort of, she expected that would rule out the directionality hypothesis. The problem, though, was that there wasn't a control condition in the opposite direction where you would have a subtraction situation where it was in the right direction but was also still impossible. She only did a control condition with this addition. And so she did find what she expected, which was that infants in that case looked longer at the display of 3 than the display of 2.
And so on the basis of that, she argued, okay, well, we have evidence. This is sufficient enough to support the argument or the claim that infants can add and subtract. Well, me being the contrarian that I am, there's still yet another alternative explanation for the findings. Mm-hmm. So another alternative explanation is that, again, to provide context, I'm only going to refer to the addition condition, but the same argument applies to the subtraction condition. But just to make the argument a bit simpler, I want to refer to that condition. So another reason they could have looked longer at the outcome of one is because the identity was impossible. Let me be clear about what I mean by that. So during the addition condition, where they were shown initially a stage that consisted of a single puppet, the screen rotates up, and then a second puppet is put behind the screen, and then they're shown an outcome of one. Well, that's like a magical disappearance. It's impossible in that way. Like, where did the second object go? So in that context, they're not necessarily attending to the numerical inconsistency of that event, but rather just the magical disappearance of the second puppet. Mm-hmm. Again, that's still a simpler explanation than arguing that babies are adding and subtracting. So again, you would need a control to rule that out. Now, it turns out that there was an experiment. So I did some digging last night, and it turns out that there was an experiment that did try to address this particular confound. It was an experiment, mm-hmm. It was an experiment by Simon Hespos and Rochat. I may be mispronouncing it. It was conducted in 1995. And the experiment itself consisted of 2 experiments. They had an experiment, the replication of Karen. I should just refer to her by her last name, Wynn. There was
the Wynn study.
Yeah, the Wynn study. So they replicated a Wynn study, and then they ran this control condition where they really tried to get at this impossible identity confound. And what they showed is that even when you control for this confound, the babies attend longer to the arithmetically impossible event. So again, so the conclusion they draw in that particular study is that no, what Karen Wynn is showing is that babies are in fact adding and subtracting. Because even when you do control for the identity, so the way they do that, for example, is they would have the possible arithmetic event. So after the, so in the addition condition, the possible arithmetic event would be an outcome of two. Mm-hmm. Moreover, the identities of the dolls are the same as those that they saw during familiarization. And then they would have another event that also showed an outcome of two. However, one of the dolls was different from what they had seen during familiarization, so the identity is impossible. And the idea is if their responses were being driven by detection of impossible identity, then they should show longer looking to that second event and not to the first. But even when you include this control, they look longer at only the arithmetically impossible event.
So that, like, also to me is then surprising, because doesn't that also tell you some limitation? Or do, like, I'm not familiar with that paper because I haven't read it, but so do they look...
So,
in other words, this is also like an impossible event, right? Seeing an object that changed, and then our infants, is that like compared to a baseline where the two objects are exactly the same? Do they still look longer at that one? And then it's just they look even longer at the numerically impossible event?
So they don't actually address what the concern that you raise right now. What they do instead ask is, because they were also surprised that the babies wouldn't show an elevated looking to the arithmetically possible but identity impossible event. And the reason they were surprised, just to be clear, for those who actually don't do research with infants per se, is because we know as infant researchers that infants, like, one of the reasons why it's important to design these carefully controlled studies is because any difference can drive looking. Mm-hmm. And so it's surprising that the infant wouldn't have detected a change in identity. And so one question, of course, one may have is, well, could that be because they just failed to discriminate the dolls? Mm-hmm. And so they run a kind of control where they repeatedly show babies one of the dolls with, mm-hmm. let's say, identity one, just to be abstract. And then following this familiarization phase, they show them that same doll paired next to the other doll, the doll that has a different identity, identity two. And what they show is that the babies do, in fact, look longer at the identity, too. So it's not that they fail to discriminate the dolls. It's something that, like, that they were just honing in on the mathematical event.
That the numerical component is sort of overriding the identity component.
That's precisely right. But when you design an experiment that only looks at identity, then they do show the pattern that you would expect. Now,
I was just going to say, that's actually very interesting, and I think relevant also to the second paper we're going to talk about, because I think another problem with some of the claims that we talk about are that it presents one really simplistic explanation without considering that multiple processes could be going on at the same time.
No, so, absolutely not. There's only one process ever. And those who...
Just one.
Yeah, and just always just one. Right.
And I think that that's really important, because we know that these things are really complex. And so the number of things that infants or children might be attending to in a particular study, whether it's familiarity, identity, number, like those things could be happening. And we try to control for those in the types of studies that we set up in conditions. But even in some of those carefully controlled studies, you can still pick up on these different processes happening and maybe even conflicting with one another under certain circumstances. So it's really complicated.
Right. So before we move on to the second study, I want to mention to me what is the biggest issue with the Wynn study. So the biggest issue...
We haven't gotten to it yet.
No. There's more. Wait. Okay. There's more.
There's more.
Right. Just when you think that we've nailed hammered the nail in the coffin. No. There's still more hammering yet to do. So the biggest issue to me were the stats that were used to back up the claim that infants can add and subtract. So let me be very clear about the issue that I have. So the claim that infants can add and subtract were based on one-tailed dependent samples t-tests. Now, for anybody who knows statistics, they know that this, in general, is a no-no. So yeah. For those who aren't that familiar with one-tailed, because it's possible that parents are listening, and if this is not your cup of tea, you can just sort of tune out. But for those who care, the problem with, well, so what a one-tailed test is testing is a directional hypothesis. So in this context, so it makes some sense. So she's testing in this context whether infants would look longer at the impossible limit than the possible limit, but not the other way around. And again, the reason she's testing this, just to be fair, is because that's the expectation. That is, if infants are adding and subtracting, they should look longer at the impossible event than at the possible event. The problem, however, with using a one-tailed test is that your false positive rate shoots up.
Yep.
And in fact, the p-value that you would have gotten in a two-tailed test is divided in half. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at her actual p-values. And now she doesn't report the precise p-value. She just says, or in the paper just says, the p-value was less than 0.05. Mm-hmm. Now, if you double 0.05, that would put you at 0.1. By conventional thresholds, that's not statistically significant. And so you have to wonder why she chose to use a one-tailed test. Another sort of curious thing is that it wasn't the case that she used one-tailed tests throughout. They were only used to assess the test events.
I actually didn't pick up on that. So
yeah, so
good
these,
to point out.
These claims are based on one-tailed tests. And so again, if let's say on a two-tailed test you get a p-value of 0.08, of mm-hmm. course, by, again, traditional standards, that's not significant. We wouldn't call that statistically significant. But if you use a one-tailed test, your p-value goes down to 0.04. And therefore, you can argue. But again, that's not by any stretch of the imagination, to me at least, statistically significant. And this may well explain why, and this is where we can sort of transition, unless you have something to say about this.
No, I think that completely,
well,
it's...
Well, this may well explain follow-up replication attempts that failed. It may be because this finding was a false positive. You're reporting one-tailed tests. Which is unconventional, especially in the context where you're making these strong claims. Again, extraordinary claims would require extraordinary evidence and extraordinary statistics. And the statistics don't justify this argument that babies are adding and subtracting. Moreover, there were no effect size, at least as far as I could tell, there were no effect size estimates provided. So I don't know how strong the effects were. There were, of course, no Bayes factors. I mean, that's something that's more a recent sort of.
Mm-hmm. You could probably compute effect sizes based on what she had if you really wanted to, but they weren't provided. And again, if we're reporting on one-tailed tests, even now, again, and this might be a historical difference as we move into some of better practices that I think we see now, they're even using alphas of 0.05 is becoming a source of contention and whether or not that's really a stringent enough test. And so doing one-tailed tests where you're basically increasing your alpha twofold, that is certainly can be problematic. And I agree, could in this other paper that we're going to chat about where we see some lack of replication. I also, as a researcher, and I know I'm not an infant researcher, so I know all the infant researchers are going to get mad at me.
So everybody, Dina, just disregard everything she says after this.
Just ignore everything I say. Some of the sample sizes in these studies are 16 infants, right? So, I mean, it's just such a small sample. And I know some of the manipulations are within subjects. And so that gives you some more power to compare across within the same participants. But still, these are, again, strong claims based on 16 infants and then making claims about the innateness of all infants having the ability to add and subtract. That's pretty brazen.
I will say this is an improvement over Piaget, who used his own children to draw really strong, to make an entire fucking theory.
Send the bar real low there, Dion.
Yeah. As Dion only would. Oh, let me make a correction. So I said that this paper was published in Science. It actually was published in Nature, so I'm sorry. Let me correct the record. We're all about being precise and being correct. And yeah, so fellow listeners, please do forgive me. The paper was published in Science. Published in Nature, not Science. So therefore, this paper is just ignore all the arguments we've made.
Yeah, applies anymore.
Nothing applies.
Just Nature, no big deal.
Right, exactly, right. Which is, yeah, I guess, so, fitting.
Yeah.
Right.
Ah, it's so good.
Right.
So the other paper that we, read and wanted to talk about then was this Cohen and Marks paper. So Leslie Cohen and Catherine Marks, it looks like when this paper was written, I'm not sure.
2002.
They're still at University of Texas Austin.
Cohen's retired.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. He's actually my academic grandfather, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, remember I made the comment last episode. Yeah, so he's David Rackeson's postdoc. Or he was David Rackeson's postdoc advisor. So I guess he's somewhat my academic grandfather, I guess. But although he was David's postdoc advisor, so what does that mean about me? Because I was David's grad student. It's some complicated relationship. I don't know.
Like a step research grandfather.
Something like that. Right. Like David got remarried or something.
But yeah, this was a replication attempt at this Karen Wynn study in part, and then a really well put together set of various different controls and conditions to test some alternative hypotheses and explanations for what Karen Wynn found. And the real basics there that they were trying to determine were these, some of the arguments that you have already mentioned, Dion. So one being that this might just be about directionality. That's one easy possible explanation. And although Karen Wynn had one condition, she didn't really test all possible conditions to get at directionality. And then the second, it's just about familiarity. And so this was not addressed in Karen Wynn's paper at all.
This
which is
worth, I don't mean to cut you off, but this is worth spelling out. So you should spell it out. What they mean by that.
Yeah, so in Karen Wynn's study, one of the easiest explanations for what she found was that infants were shown multiple trials. So I think it was it like four each, I believe?
I'm not exactly sure what the exact number is.
I'm pretty sure. It was like three or four trials of each of the displays, which means that, for example, in the addition condition, infants were seeing one item displayed on the screen, the occluder comes up, something's added, and then when it comes down, the impossible event is that they still see one item on the screen. And this was repeated many times, plus a familiarization trial at the very beginning of the study, where they were simply shown items up on the stage. So one possible explanation is that infants are being impacted by familiarity, that we know that they may look longer at things they've seen before. So I've seen a display of just one item many more times than the impossible event of seeing, in the addition one, we would see two items is our possible event. So there might be the reason why they're looking at the impossible event of just one item after one's been added is actually just because they're more familiar with seeing that one item on the stage.
Right. So at any given point during familiarization, all they ever saw was a single. So even though they were in the addition condition whereby one object was added to another object to yield an outcome of two, they only ever saw a single puppet. And so it might have been that they sort of familiarized to. Now, it's worth being clear about the distinction between, so infant, as an infant researcher, I feel obliged to make this distinction clear. So infant researchers really have those who test preverbal infants, they really have two paradigms at their disposal. They can use what's called habituation, which is often referred to as infant-controlled habituation. So the baby decides when the test trials are presented. Or familiarization, which is where the experimenter decides how many trials an infant will see of a particular event. So in the Wynn study, the procedure that was used was familiarization. And the problem, however, with familiarization, this has been worked out quite cleanly by some researchers in the 80s, why am I blanking on their names right now? This is really embarrassing. In any case, they came up with the habituation, Hunter and Ames. That's Hunter and Ames. So Hunter and Ames described a model that got into the conditions under which infants will show familiarity preference or novelty preference. Mm-hmm. And what they show is that the age of the infant affects whether or not they show a familiarity preference. So it turns out that younger infants tend to show familiarity preferences earlier than older infants. Another factor that matters is the complexity of the stimulus. So the more complex the stimulus, the more likely infants are to show a familiarity preference. Whereas with habituation, what's happening with habituation, at least as the theory goes, is that the baby is, as the baby is being shown the stimulus, they're forming an internal model of the stimulus. And the idea is they'll continue to look at the stimulus to the extent that there's to the extent that there is a discrepancy between their internal model and what they're being shown. But what's nice about habituation is that any increase in looking subsequently at test can't be attributed to a familiarity bias, because again, you would have habituated infants and they choose when to get to basically grow bored and when to look elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so again, the problem, one of the, as Candace just mentioned, one of the issues with the WIN study is that the response to the outcome of one, again, this outcome is what they saw during familiarization. Mm-hmm. All they ever saw was an outcome of one. And so showing them an outcome of one at test is very much consistent with what they were being shown. And their lack of an increase in looking to the outcome of two may well be the result of them just showing a familiarity bias, that is a bias to attend to the thing that they've seen the most, which is one.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. And that's a much more simplistic explanation than babies are computing numerical computations.
Right. Now, so the Cohen and Marx paper is a really nice paper. I agree, mm-hmm. but it's not without its flaws.
And, of course, no, for sure.
And I will say that based on that explanation I just gave, one obvious experiment that should have been run that wasn't run is an experiment where babies are habituated.
Yeah.
Like,
that's what I was thinking.
Like, if that's the argument, so I agree with him that is a possible explanation. Then go and run the fucking control experiment and habituate infants. Like, you literally just spelled out the conditions under which you would expect different kinds of looking, patterns of looking. So go run that experiment. So that's one of the knocks on this particular paper. But that notwithstanding, the paper does a really good job, I think, at really exploring these alternative explanations. And so now I'm going to hand the floor back to Candy.
Yeah, and I will not say that I will... It's a longer paper. It has numerous experiments, mm-hmm. so three different experiments, and then comparisons across two of the experiments. So there's a lot of information in there. But I think that one of the key things that they set out is setting out a really good explanation of what we would expect, what would be the expected pattern of findings that we would have based on each of these explanations. And I agree, it's not perfectly clean. And in fact, they point that out in their data that they don't end up finding really clear support for just familiarity or for just directionality. They also end up looking at, as they move farther, another possible explanation, which is that infants also just like to look at more, like whatever that is, more items is better. So I might spend time looking at more items than fewer items.
So less is not more, more is more.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And so they do this throughout many different manipulations and conditions. And I'm not sure how much detail you want to go into, Dion, if you want to walk through any of it. But I think that what my overall takeaway from this was that in including all of these various different conditions, the main thing that comes through is very much not a strong line of support for Karen Wynn's initial claims.
Exactly.
That infants are computing numerical computation. Instead, it seems like familiarity does seem to play a role, and also this idea of the number of items. And the way that they look at familiarity, just to give the listeners context, by comparing across different blocks of the experiment. So looking at infants' responses in the first block of an experiment versus the second block. So in the first block being less familiar with items, and then later on they're already more familiar with items. I do think, I agree with you though, Dion, that the strongest test of this would have been using a habituation paradigm. where we could really see that an infant has become so familiar with this object that they're no longer interested in it. So it's that curvilinear relationship between experience with an item and then our interest in it first being really high and then eventually dropping off. And that would probably be a good manipulation to include in there. But yeah, the results are a bit more mixed and not clear. And that's why it brings me back to what I said earlier, which was it actually seems like they found evidence of multiple processes happening at the same time. So it depends on at what point in the study are we measuring this. So familiarity might win out at one point, but then eventually maybe I'm paying more attention to just how many items are there.
So I agree with everything you just said. The one study I did like, so I had mixed feelings about this replication attempt. So I will say, for in the sake of full disclosure, I should be all on board with the study because Cohen and Marx, we all come from the same theoretical perspective. But I try to be as critical towards DG, domain general studies, as I am toward nativist studies.
Yeah.
But I will say that the one study I did enjoy in this particular paper is, I think it was experiment 3, which was a kind of control experiment for the replication attempt and extension of the wind study. And so that study, I think, cleanly gets at familiarity. And so just, again, to be clear, the idea is that maybe infants aren't adding and subtracting at all, but rather what they were doing is they just were attending to the thing they saw the most. So the event they saw the most was the event that involved just a single object. And so what this necessarily means is that, or what this sort of supports is a replicate, as a control study whereby the babies are simply shown a single item on the stage. And the idea is if, in fact, responses in experiment 1 were driven not by a math mechanism, for example, or a math process, but rather just by familiarity bias, then they should show the same pattern of looking in this experiment as they do in the first experiment. That's precisely what they showed. So the infants who, for example, were familiarized to a single puppet, they looked longest at the outcome of one. I think the results were a little bit more complicated for the subtraction condition, maybe not, but that's roughly the idea. And so this right there, again, would have been a nice control study and an easy control study to include in the original Wynn study. That is, think about these possible alternative explanations, run the relevant control conditions, and if the data are what the data are, and they are going to be what they are going to be. And so if the data analyzed across these studies turn out to support this computational process, then that's the conclusion you can make. But again, these kinds of controls weren't run. And because they are not run, because they weren't conducted, it's important to show some caution in making these claims. And I will say that having said that, another issue, again, I keep weaving between the pros of this study as well as the cons. another issue with the Cohen and Marx study is that the study was just fundamentally different than what Karen Wynn than the procedure Karen Wynn used. And so it's hard to...
Yeah, experiment 3.
Well, all the experiments. And I'll be clear about what I mean. So it's hard to make any comparisons when the paradigms are completely different. So, for example, in the Wynn study, the babies were only ever shown 2 test events. In the Cohen study, in all 3 experiments, they were shown 4 test events. So there's a difference that could drive the responses. Moreover... It wasn't the case that the first 2 test events that the babies were shown. So this wouldn't have been a problem. That is, showing babies 4 test events wouldn't have been a problem if the first 2 test events represented replications of what the babies had seen in the Wynn study. So if one of the test events was the impossible outcome of 1 and the other one being the possible outcome of 2 for the babies who were habituated to or who shown that who were assigned to the addition condition. However, they use the Latin square, and so they counterbalance the order in which these test events were presented. And so it's hard to know how much we can conclude from the Cohen study and how much of that applies to the Wynn study.
Sure. Yeah, just to give everybody context, in the Cohen study, they had 4 different possible outcomes. Sorry, it's my cat knocking things over. They had 4 different possible outcomes here of, like, different outcomes in various directions. So outcomes of 0, 1, 2, and 3. And again, with different combinations of whether those were in addition or subtraction trials. But there were in total then 4 different possible outcomes per addition versus subtraction condition. So they had versus in the WIN study where they only had impossible versus possible outcomes.
Yep, that's right. I should also say that another issue, I think, with this...
Before you move on, I just wanted to say then, so in relation to that, I agree with you. I appreciate if we have direct replication so that we could sort of, I think that would have been a really great premise of just directly replicating Karen Wynn's study. The other thing though here is that when we start to get at some of these things, and this is generally when we talk about replication, it's like how much of a little difference between a study matters to then say like, nope, this is just so different that if you did it exactly the way that I did, then you would have found it. Well, then how robust this really is whatever it is that you're talking about?
This is precisely my argument when I hear, like, I agree, it's a double-edged sword. Like, on the one hand, it is important to directly replicate. But the problem is, like, let's say I do not a direct replication, but a conceptual replication, and I fail to show the response. Of course, one can easily say, well, it's because you didn't do a direct replication. Well, then how fucking robust is the effect?
Like, yeah, I think that's a really good argument is like, well, if we were to argue against what Cohen finds and says like, well, but it's different because they included these other types of test events. Well, then is it really robust? I'm not sure whether or not.
It would have to be robust in order to support a claim like this. Like if anything, you would want to show, I think you would encourage both direct and conceptual replications, because the claim that infants can add and subtract is that 5-month-olds can add and subtract is a very strong claim. And so you need both direct replications as well as conceptual replications. I would probably classify the Cohen study as more of a conceptual replication. Mm-hmm. And in the context of this conceptual replication, there wasn't a replication. The findings were quite mixed.
Technically they do find in some cases the same pattern of finding.
Yeah, on the first block, but not the second block, or on the second block, not the first block. I don't know. That seems a little bit p-hacky to me.
I just mean to say that, like, I don't think that it suggests that Karen Wynn's findings were just a false positive. I think that their findings rather suggest that maybe what Karen Wynn found was a very specific context under very specific circumstances, and that even those patterns of findings in the conditions she included could be easily explained by these alternative explanations. So when they lay those out at the beginning, they say, yeah, like these other explanations could still account for based on like the findings that she had. We don't have to actually find different findings to find support for a different hypothesis or a different explanation or process. So I did appreciate that they tried to rule some other things out. And I will say too, the other thing that I found particularly interesting and that they mentioned in the first experiment was that they did include a condition, so an impossible subtraction condition where the outcome was 0, where it was nothing. So like there's a subtraction and there's
that's exactly right.
Right, so where the outcome is that when the screen drops down, there's nothing on the stage. And they talked about a bit how even though their findings then are supporting not what Karen Wynn said, well, by including this condition, that Karen Wynn's justification for that was that, well, 0 is a special condition.
Right.
And 0 isn't the same as any other number.
Well, so the argument is that if we assume, which they're surmising, Wynn is assuming that infants espouse an accumulator mechanism that takes in pulses, and the pulses correspond to the number of things they're being shown. So if I show you one thing, then the accumulator mechanism puts out one pulse. If I show you a second thing, it puts out 2 pulses. And then by the time the event is done, the number of pulses in the mechanism corresponds to the number of things you would have seen. And the argument that they're assuming, they're sort of surmising that she would say is that, well, the default position of the accumulator mechanism is 0. So it's hard to discriminate between the default position of the accumulator mechanism and this outcome of 0. And so it's hard for me to interpret the utility in light of that argument. It's hard for me to interpret. My perspective is a little bit different than yours. It's hard for me to interpret the utility of the outcome of zero, because this is, I mean, let's assume that they do, let's just grant her that they do have an accumulator mechanism. Now, I didn't actually see that term used in the original study. Maybe she wrote about it elsewhere, but let's assume.
Yeah, I think they cite her arguments elsewhere.
Oh, okay. So then she believes that babies have this accumulator mechanism. Well, if that's the case, and the default position is zero, and you have evidence to suggest that in fact this is the case, then it's really not clear to me why you would include an outcome of zero, because it would tell you absolutely nothing. I mean, it's a confounded event.
I think in this case they were including it because it was testing that directionality hypothesis, gotcha. Right? Which is that if I subtract items, but you get like it's in the right direction, but it's still the wrong amount, which in this case, because they're using small number, this incorrect subtraction would have ended up with zero.
Right.
So just like the three, right. we have one, we add one, we get three. In this case, we have one or we have two, we subtract one, but we get zero.
Right, math, hard.
So they're trying to balance on both of those sides for directionality. And so they find some evidence there. And then also in the other study, finding evidence again of just like, at least once we get to a second block where we're past some preference for maybe familiarity, there's that a real linear increase of like just increased looking times for more items on the screen or more items in the display. So they look the least at zero, which... Mm-hmm. Intuitively to me makes sense, because like, what are you looking at?
There's that's another issue with the zero outcome for me. I'm just not convinced that was useful, because again, babies, why would you expect the baby to look at an empty display? Like, why would you as an adult
impossible events, forget all the,
but if anything, that what that tells you is, I get what you're saying, but if anything, what that tells you is that they're if let's say assume that they do look longer at that event, it's still hard to interpret that. Could that be because they're expecting an event to happen? It's like, I've only ever seen events, and so you're showing me an empty display. When is this event going to happen? So it's a confounded event even still.
I think that there's a lot of alternative explanations. There's no clear explanation, but I do think it's important to include, because it could be simply that, right? That just looking at the easiest explanation for something there of looking longer is still a violation of expectation. It's just a basic, in a basic explanation of like object permanence, that something was there and I expected something to be there and now there's nothing.
I guess what I'm saying is it's confounded in ways that the 1, 2, and 3 outcomes aren't. And there's like multiple alternative explanations that make you sort of question the utility again of using this event. It's like you would have to run either show babies lots of different test events that control for this, which is a problem in and of itself, because babies, as you would expect, have limited attention spans or have lots of different conditions which would require massive, getting babies is very difficult. And so it's expensive. And so this event doesn't really tell me anything. But I guess that the point is not necessarily to assess this event in isolation, it's to assess this event in the context of these other events. That's precisely what you're getting at.
Yeah. Right. And the other thing that I found interesting about this was in their third experiment, where they eliminated all of the things that were in Karen Wynn's study with a hand coming in and out, and they just had the items displayed. And this also when I was reading that, it started to get me thinking about where do these researchers think that infants perceive the beginning and end of an event? So, like, you keep showing the same items up in a display, and, like, you're taking some away, you're adding some. Sometimes it's happening behind the screen. Sometimes there's a hand, and now we're at the next trial where now I'm showing you two items. But I was like, what are we getting at quite there? Like, when does the infant perceive the end of a display? Because the items are the same in all of the displays. And so that just got me really thinking about where...
Yeah.
We need to do something to maybe get at that a little bit more, because I just felt like, for me, it's just like, if I was sitting through that event, I would see all of these items and screens coming up and down and blinds going up and down. And I don't think that the infants necessarily perceive those all as the separate events that we think they're perceiving them as.
I think you're spot on.
I don't think that they're any of the conditions or anything that they've used really controlled for that or can explain that, because they're just continuing the procedure throughout the whole study with all of these various events. And that's why I think when, in the Cohen paper where they find these differences between blocks, I think that that is support for that, that infants are maybe perceiving this entire study as a single event of things happening again and again. It's not these nice, beautifully cut off trials that we're implementing as experimenters.
I think you're spot on. And that may well explain the messiness of the data in the Cohen study. Like, you're right. Like, it is, it's clear to us as the experimenters where one trial starts and where one trial ends. But seeing these events in the context of familiarization or habituation from the infant's perspective can be quite confusing. Yeah. And given that it's hard to, like, it would be hard to know what they're attending to. Mm-hmm. And I think this points to a larger issue, like what, I mean, this is a common thing in these studies, like to, you know, we as experimenters know where, you know, we know when one event begins and one event ends, but I am unfamiliar with any arguments or any papers that examine whether infants perceive the beginnings and endings in the same way that the experimenters are intending them to perceive the beginnings and endings. Moreover, it's unclear whether or not, let's assume there is a discrepancy, like in what ways is that discrepancy, that is infants seeing the event in one way, the events unfolding in one way, and us as experimenters seeing them unfold in a different way, to what extent that impacts, and in what ways it impacts their subsequent looking. And like what sorts of things can, you know, what would be required, like what would you have to do as an experimenter to really, to, because I think this is a very important point. And this applies both to people with nativist leanings as well as to, with people with my leanings.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I never actually really thought about until I started reading this Cohen paper, and it just sparked that in me where I was like, okay, well, what? And yeah, to your question, like, what could we do? It's really hard because at first my thought was, well, we should just show infants, like, not necessarily a single trial, but in these, like, within subjects paradigms, there's so many different trials and conditions, and so maybe using a between subjects design would actually be preferable in these cases so that infants are seeing less.
Let's take this a step at a time. So how would that address the principal addition event concern that you raise? Because even if you do, so the between subjects is only useful for the presentation of the test events, but you're still showing infants in both, in like, let's say, in both conditions, you're still showing them the same unfolding of the addition event. And that's where your concern lies. It's not in the test events, which between subjects would address. It's really in the unfolding of the event.
It's really both. To me, it's both. Okay. Because, like, there, I mean, so say within a single trial of this, of the WIN study, right? I see one item, I see a screen go up, I see an item added, I see the screen go down. That's one test event. And so whether or not infants are even seeing all of that as one thing, who knows? But then it's also the multiple trials across different events. So, like, so then what happens now that that trial is over? Well, all the items disappear and we move on to the next trial that starts the same way with one item there. So maybe they're perceiving between trials as being still one single event, which I think because of the data, again, that, and this is just limited just from looking at Cohen's data of this this paradigm, because those, you see such changes in their responses to the same types of events across blocks, I think that that suggests that's partly what's happening, is that infants are not seeing these as distinct events. There's some relation between them to the very least. But yeah, no, even if we only had, even within one trial, does an infant perceive that as really being one single event? Or is it, you showed me one thing and then this goes away and now we're looking at something else, who knows? I was actually, I think, really just interested in how did they actually transition between trials? And I don't know that I really saw a complete explanation for that. Like, they're very detailed in explaining how one single trial goes. So, you know, the you see the display, there is an item just there, then the occluder comes up, and then another item's added, and the occluder comes down, and then we measure looking time. But then what happens when you go to the next trial?
Yeah, so, right. So you're right. They don't make that clear, but I will say that generally what infant researchers do, myself included, is because this, I mean, this is not something that we don't think about, of course. Something that we think about. And one solution often is to, between events, like to insert between events what are called attention getters. So these are completely unrelated events. It's usually, for me, the kind of attention getters I use are like illuminating circles that make a noise, mm-hmm. that have like a noise that's synchronized with the illumination. And the actual color of the event is like, it's like presented on a black screen. It's completely different from what they will have been, or what they are being shown. And so this is kind of how we separate the events. And the thinking is that because these events are so drastically different, mm-hmm. that it's hard not to see the subsequent presentation of the event that we care about, that is the event that we're habituating them to, as the beginning of that same event. Mm-hmm. And importantly, distinct from the attention getter. Now, again, that's what infant researchers typically do.
Yeah,
but it's not clear that they're doing that here.
I just looked back to be sure, and all they do is, instead of the occluder rising, that's the screen, a mini blind comes down.
Oh, okay. So it's yeah. I mean, but still, though, it's you know, the occluder is kind of similar to the mini blind, and
yeah. So to me, that's like it almost seems like just two different occluders, right? Yeah. So it's like, how are infants really distinguishing a mini blind coming down from the occluder that comes up and just gets? I think there's just a lot more questions that I have. And again, it's not knocking these studies in their attempt to figure these things out. And we have to, science moves slowly and we have to start somewhere. But I think there's these alternate explanations we have to start thinking about of what infants are actually attending to. And then what are some ways that we could address that? So yeah, I thought that this was a really interesting follow-up that got me thinking about some other things.
Yeah, no, that's really important. And I guess what I wanted to say is because of those concerns, because of the possibility of these alternative explanations, this is yet another reason why one should be cautious before making these kinds of claims. I mean, we've identified, I haven't been keeping track, but we've identified several. quite a few competing explanations for the main finding. And until these, either some of them or ideally all of them, have been addressed, as well as others that we may not even be touching on, until these things are addressed, I think you have to be careful about concluding that 5-month-olds, pre-verbal infants, can add and subtract. Another explanation possibly, although this one is a bit more difficult, but this is an explanation that's been given in studies that test numerical capacity. It's just the general surface area of things. And mm-hmm. so in the dot displays, for example, in the early dot display experiments, the infants are shown a certain number of dots on each trial during habituation, and then they're shown at test a display of dots that is either consistent with the number of dots that they would have seen during mm-hmm. habituation or inconsistent. The problem with, let's say that the babies, and this is what these studies do show, like the babies do look longer at the inconsistent event. Well, it could be because the inconsistent event is inconsistent numerically, or mm-hmm. could be because when you calculate the overall surface area that the dots take up, they mm-hmm. just take up more surface area than in the possible event. Now, I yeah. will say, that I think there have been these kinds of controls.
I would say the one you talked about earlier,
clear field of mix,
looking at identity, yeah. I think that would probably get at that. So if they're,
and even in that context, that's the clear field and mix study. And so what they show in that study is that when you keep number constant in the displays, but you manipulate contour length or you manipulate surface area, the idea is that if babies are attending to the number of items in a display, if I keep the number of items constant and I manipulate contour length, they should treat both events similarly if they're attending to number. But what they show is that that's not the case, that they show an increase in looking when the number of items in the display is kept constant, but what you're manipulating is contour length. And so it really complicates, these explanations or these sort of theories about infants' numerical capacities. Are we actually tapping numerical cognition, or are we tapping some low-level perceptual process that is confounded with the numerical capacities? And once you unconfound these things, you show, like Clearfield and Mix do, that the data are just much more complicated than otherwise thought.
Yeah, I I'm on board. We need to keep doing more research in this area and try to figure out what these things are. And I think that we're moving in the right direction. I think since this Karen Wynn paper, there's a lot more well-designed research that is looking at all various possible explanations and testing various hypotheses. And it's still going to be messy. I think most research with infants is going to be messy,
right.
But we're at least moving in the right direction.
That's right. And there are, like you said, we are moving in the right direction, and statistics themselves are improving. And mm-hmm. I think, like, you know, I'm sure you implement mixed effects models. Like, mm-hmm. mixed effects models would have been appropriate here, like where you mm-hmm. model subjects, for example, as, you know, you model random intercepts for the subjects. Mm-hmm. The problem, again, is that by not implementing these models, your parameter estimates are likely overestimates. Mm-hmm. And so when you, and this goes back, this sort of, I'm referring to when I make this, making this argument, I'm referring to Tal Yarkoni's generalizability crisis paper. The idea is that by not modeling subjects, for example, or stimuli or experimenter room as random subjects, not only should you temper your claims because you're only testing a certain kind of, your results only apply to the participants that you studied, only apply to that particular context, the particular stimuli, you're limited into the claims you can make. But more importantly, your estimates are likely overestimates. And so when you account for these additional sources of variance, your estimates are adjusted accordingly. And it turns out that they're adjusted when you run simulation, they're adjusted downwards. And so the point that I'm getting at is that, again, if the claim that you want to make, which is fine, is that infants can add and subtract, not only do you have to run these well-controlled experiments, you have to run the right kinds of stats. One-tailed dependent sample t-test won't cut it. They just won't cut it.
Not anymore. I hope that we are becoming much more critical of the types of statistics that people are using and the methodology that they're using. So I think that goes back to what you asked before, was would this paper make it today? And I don't think that it would. I would hope that, especially in a journal like Nature, I would hope that this would be, people would be much more critical of what was presented, including things like methodology stats and the claims that were made at the end.
Right.
So what's your takeaway, Dion?
That
can babies add and subtract?
You might be surprised to hear this takeaway, but it's complicated. It's complicated.
No, I agree.
I mean, like, maybe, but like the Cohen and Mark study showed, it's like, yeah, I guess sometimes they do, but then sometimes they don't, and it's just messy. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's very complicated. And like, you have some studies taking a step back. You have some studies that support the claim. So Simon, Hespos, and Rochot, they ostensibly support the claim. But then you have this Cohen paper mm-hmm. that failed to replicate. And it's sort of like hard to know what the takeaway is. I mean, if anything, the takeaway is temper your claims and run the right kinds of controls and run the right kinds of statistics. That's mm-hmm. the claim. And assuming that you have converging evidence, once you've done that, then you may be warranted in claiming that babies can add and subtract. But until then, be careful about what you claim. You know, that's sort of my takeaway. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. I never want to say that it's impossible, because is it possible that infants can do this? Of course it's possible. I just don't think, reflecting on the evidence we have yet, that it's strong enough to make that claim. And I think that Cohen and Mark's paper makes a stronger claim that things like familiarity would be a better explanation. Again, it's not just clear cut that that's the only thing happening, but that did come across as a stronger pattern to explain some of the findings. And they didn't find strong evidence in favor of Wynn's explanation. And I would say that, again, maybe we will find those things in the future. Maybe it is something that we can find evidence for. But at this point, can we make claims that infants can add and subtract? My vote is we don't have the evidence for that.
Right.
So not that they can't, but we just don't have enough evidence to say that they can at this point.
I agree 100%. This has been yet another fun conversation. I, of course, look forward to having many more of these conversations with you.
Very excited. I hope everybody keeps joining us and listening in and sharing and share your opinions with us, your hot takes. We want to hear them. Send them our way.
Yes. Also, we are looking for people to interview, especially underrepresented scholars, graduate students, postdocs, faculty. We are all about increasing diversity in science. And now that we have this platform, this is one clear medium to try to contribute to these larger diversity issues. I especially feel compelled as an underrepresented minority myself to do what I can to try to contribute to this effort. And so if during or while listening to these podcasts, you know, you have a developmental psychologist, because that's the one of the constraints, because this is a developmental psychology podcast. If you have a developmental psychologist URM in mind, you know, send them our way. And just keep listening.
We'd love to have you and hear your ideas. So if you've been having a lot of your own thoughts while you're listening to our podcast, reach out and we'd like to lift your voices.
Right. And even if you are, I will say, and even if you aren't an URM and you want to be interviewed because you just, you know, vehemently disagree with everything we say, please shoot us an email. We would love to have you on. Mm-hmm. This podcast isn't meant to be adversarial. This podcast is meant to discuss the science and whether or not the claims that we make are supported by the science. That's my goal. I do have a theoretical bias, but again, I'm trying to analyze when I discuss these findings. I'm trying to do it through my science lens, through science with my science hat on and my objective hat on.
Well, we appreciate you listening and check us out next time. Follow us on Twitter and at It's an 8 PC on Twitter. Check us out there and we'll see you next time.
Well, and before we go, our email is, what is our email handle? I don't know it off the top of my head. I should, which is, here, I can look it up now. Let's see. Our email handle is,
it's theitsinatepodcast@gmail.com.
There you go. So yeah, so if you have any questions or anything like that, reach out to us. It's been another fun episode. Thanks for indulging me, Candy, and I look forward to next week. Next week is going to be a very fun episode. We're actually interviewing my graduate advisor, who's a very interesting, very brilliant, clever guy, and I think that the listeners will enjoy that episode as well.
Yes, absolutely. Check it out. We'll be talking more about things and our beliefs and perspectives on innateness. And then also, because we're chatting with mentors, we'll also give you a little bit of feedback on things like do's and don'ts. And if you're interested in graduate school, we'll have some expertise there from our guests.
Yep.
So,
all right.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks. Till next time.